For many of us, seeing the beauty in other people, being kind and compassionate towards other people, that comes pretty easily. But what's really hard is seeing the beauty in ourselves and being kind and compassionate consistently towards ourselves, especially when difficult things happen. Perhaps someone's critical of us, or we make a mistake. We beat up on ourselves. You could call it the inner critic, or that voice in the head that says mean things. Or you could call it self-hatred. What can we do in these circumstances to interrupt this cycle and learn to befriend ourselves consistently? Sounds True has created the Self-Acceptance Project to investigate this question. We've invited the participation of spiritual teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, visionary writers, all to look at how can we learn to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves on a consistent basis. Thank you for joining us and welcome. This episode features Aaron Olivo, an assistant clinical professor of medical psychology at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Aaron's current research investigates the use of mind-body strategies in both medical and mental health settings. With Sounds True, she has released the audio program Free Yourself from Anxiety, a Mind-Body Prescription. Aaron, to begin with, I know that you work as a clinical psychologist working directly with clients who suffer from many different kinds of challenges, but challenges such as addictions and self-destructive behavior, overeating. And I'd love to begin our conversation by knowing, what's your basic perspective, your basic viewpoint on helping clients who have these destructive patterns, break free of those patterns, and learn to be more kind and compassionate towards themselves?
I would start by saying that I think that often sort of this negative self-talk and sort of feelings of unworthiness that I see in almost every one of my patients, it comes in sort of two varieties and not mutually exclusive. I think one patient of mine might have both issues happening. But essentially, I find that it seems that there are times when they get sort of emotionally triggered into an emotionally sort of emotional state of mind where that starts to trigger them into all this negative self-talk. So something makes them feel very fearful or something makes them feel very angry. And then the secondary sort of response to that, or almost like a symptom of what I would call emotion mind, is this sort of lack of self-acceptance and a real sort of sense of unworthiness, maybe even the emotion of shame that comes with all this cognitive sort of negative self-talk. That's one way that I see it show up a lot. And so that is yet another symptom, like their other behaviors might be a symptom of an emotionally triggered state of mind. Then there's also sort of a experience that I find that a lot of my patients have, that once they even get good at being able to manage their emotions and manage those triggers, they still are left with sort of a pervasive core sense of unworthiness. And that in and of itself is the thing that I find then starts triggering this emotion mind state. And so it can be sort of this cyclical pattern where, you know, if it's their own negative self-talk that's starting it all off and starting the ball rolling, then that leads to some negative behaviors or impulsive behaviors. And then that leads to even more negative self-talk. And right. And then that's sort of like a more core issue. So one is more of a sort of pervasive sense of unworthiness. And the other is this, when I'm in a bad place, that's where my brain goes. And I've got to, you know, that's just making it harder for me to climb out of the hole I was already in. So I think we deal with them a little bit differently, most of the same strategies, but it's just good, I think, to understand sort of which is which and what's happening for a particular patient.
Let's talk about both of these different manifestations of a lack of self-acceptance, starting with this core sense of unworthiness. What mm-hmm. is that, and how do you work with that?
I think a lot of times I work with most things in a cognitive behavioral fashion and incorporating some elements of mindfulness in first understanding where we are and what we're feeling and what we're thinking, and then starting to work with those thoughts and the behaviors. And so I start by asking people who come in and say sort of my biggest issue is that I just think that I'm damaged. I just think that I am I'm worthless, is to really start to understand, well, what do you think is valuable in the world? So I might ask somebody to actually sort of do an inventory, not for themselves, because I find that most of the people who sort of feel this way have a very different set of expectations for the rest of the world and everyone else in the world than they do for themselves. And so I think we have to start with normalizing that and sort of having a sense of, well, what makes a person worthy and valuable? And I ask them to do an exercise of sort of listing those traits. And then I might ask them to take their own inventory of, well, what's going on with you that you think is just so horrible about you? And it's funny because a lot of the things that people put on the list of what makes them not valuable and not worthy don't show up anywhere on the list of what makes somebody valuable. So, for instance, what someone looks like is not often on the list of what makes a person worthy and valuable. But that's the thing that they beat up on themselves for and can't stand and hate about themselves and treat themselves so cruelly about. And they decide that that means something about their core worth when they never think that of someone else, right? Success in their job or wealth or, you know, those kinds of external things are not what people put on the list of what at their core makes a person valuable. Right. And so I think it's important to understand that disconnect. And that can be a really sort of eye-opening experience, that kind of an exercise for someone.
So I make a list of the qualities in other people that I think make them worthy and wonderful people. And mm-hmm. then I look at myself and I make that list inside myself as well. And mm-hmm. then how does that generate this shift inside me? I mean, can it really just happen through this type of cognitive analysis?
Not solely. It's not magic. It certainly isn't a magic bullet. So, but it is the beginning of the conversation of what is it? What number am I doing on myself, right? So what's my racket here? I believe that people are valuable and worth something when they're kind, compassionate, loving people. Right? I think I am worthless because I am overweight. I don't think I have the job I'm supposed to have. I don't have the relationship I think I'm supposed to have. I don't know what else it might be, right? So I'm too short. I'm too this. I'm too that. All these external things, right? But they list all these internal qualities that if I then really press, often they will acknowledge that, well, I can be very kind and I can be very compassionate and I can be loyal. I am to other people, but the very person that they're not those things to is actually themselves when they're beating up on themselves and criticizing themselves for all these external things that they would never judge another person for. And so it begins to sort of open their eyes to this idea that, oh, hold on a second. Maybe I have to try to be a little more compassionate with myself the way I might be compassionate with someone else. And most of them, and not all, but most of them do have the skills to be able to be less critical, less judgmental, more compassionate, more accepting of other people. And so we sort of, you know, I often say to people, well, look, you have the skill set. That's great. That's a strength. Now we need to start to turn it towards yourself and start to practice those same skills with yourself.
Now, Erin, in becoming familiar with your work, I saw that you work with a form of psychological therapy approach called dialectical behavior therapy, which focuses on both validation and acceptance while simultaneously helping someone to change. And exactly. I thought that this was very interesting in the context of self-acceptance. Could there be a way that people could learn to work with themselves where they validate where they're at, but also strive to change at the same time. And I'm wondering if you can talk about those two different pulls.
Right, absolutely. So, you know, I think a lot of times people aren't willing or don't understand what in the world could be good about actually validating or accepting about themselves the things that they don't like. They often think that if they do that, that might give them free rein to be even worse than they are in some capacity, right? And so I can't validate this. I have to beat myself up about this, or else I'm not going to change it. So in the example of, let's say, an addiction, people will come to me all the time and say, you know, I am in self-loathing about the fact that I continue to drink. And I know that I shouldn't, but I can't do anything about it right now. And I'm in complete and utter self-loathing about it. And I often remind them that that self-loathing is putting them in emotion mind. And when we're in emotion mind, we're much more likely to be able to change these difficult behaviors that we engage in, because we're engaging in them because we're feeling so crappy. So that, in fact, one of the things we first have to do is practice acceptance, but we need to understand what acceptance means, right? Acceptance doesn't mean I like something. Acceptance doesn't mean I want more of it. Acceptance simply means I can acknowledge that it is here, that this is what is happening for me. And I add in the piece of trying to come to some level of an understanding and a level of hopefully forgiveness that, you know what, I'm doing the best I can right now. I need to do better. However, right now I'm doing the best I can. And beating myself up about this, not being compassionate and accepting about it, is actually keeping me further away from my goals, not closer. So when we can start to begin to practice and sort of turn our mind to this concept of accepting something we don't like about ourselves, that's the beginning of being able to change it.
Now, can you say more about the forgiveness part of that process?
Well, I often ask people to think about, you know, other people that struggle with similar issues and whether or not they feel that they could forgive, accept, have compassion for other people. And almost always across the board, they say, of course I can. Well, I completely understand why so-and-so would do that. And look at the life they've had and look at the struggles that they had and the challenges that they're experiencing. And so they have an innate ability and understanding of how to have compassion for other people who are struggling. And I just really think that it's important to start to try to turn that on in for ourselves. And one of the ways I ask people to do that sometimes is to sort of do a retrospective look at their history. And when they were a child and all the things that sort of led to the things that they are struggling with. And almost always, I sort of take them back and often do exercises that come more from a gestalt background, probably, where I ask them to actually envision themselves sitting across in a chair from them as a child. And can they offer that love, compassion, and forgiveness to that child who ultimately is going to be them? They usually can start to do that. And so that sort of an experiential exercise can be a helpful sort of beginning sort of bridge to then being able to offer that same level of compassion and forgiveness to themselves.
In a way, you're pointing to something that other guests in this Self-Acceptance Project series have spoken about, which is this capacity to take perspective on our situation. Mm-hmm. And that's what an important move that is. I wonder if you can speak to that, this idea of taking perspective.
Well, I do think that, you know, it's important to step outside and observe how it is that we're treating ourselves and how it is that we got to where we have gotten to, right? And that's the beginning of acceptance too. It's seeing the full course of who I am as a person. Because if I'm just going to look in isolation at one behavior, well, sure, I can judge that one behavior, but then I'm not taking it in the context of an entire person who, while, you know, doing some things that are destructive and impulsive, also is a wonderful, loyal friend who's there for people and able to sort of really give back and do a lot in the world, right? And so I do have to step back and look at the whole picture of something and not completely condemn myself for one small piece of something that I might need to do better. But I really do want to have that perspective on I'm a whole person and I am at my core a valuable person who sometimes makes mistakes. And we, again, I think so many of my patients have the ability to understand that and see that for other people, but not for themselves. And so we try to cultivate what we in DBT language call a wise mind perspective, which is a broader view. It sort of looks at the full course of how someone has gotten to where they are and the full sort of holistic sense of who they are as a person. So I think that that's a really important thing that we try to do.
Can you tell me more what you mean by this wise mind point of view?
Well, in DBT, we sort of divide the states of mind that people can spend much of their time in into three main states of mind. They're somewhat overlapping and not so mutually exclusive, but it's a good sort of way to start to think about it. And so I've mentioned emotion mind. That's when I'm triggered by some emotional state. I'm very much driven in my thinking and behavior by my emotion in the moment. So something has triggered me, I'm experiencing a strong emotion, and I'm going to be in an emotion mind state of mind. The sort of polar opposite of that in some ways is what we call reasonable mind or rational state of mind, where I'm not going to consider emotion or how I feel about something at all. I'm simply going to be thinking in a very logical A plus B gets me to C, and that's it, and I don't care how I feel about it kind of thing. And then the overlap of these two states of mind, if you picture sort of a Venn diagram with overlapping circles, is this state of mind that we call wise mind. And it is what it sounds like. In wisdom, we have both great logical perspective on things and a real reasonable way of looking at things, but we also can understand and acknowledge the emotional sense of something. So a person, if you think of like a person who you think of as very wise and someone who you would look to as a guide or an advisor, that person tends to be incredibly compassionate and acknowledge and validate emotion, but also be able to balance that with the need for change at times or the need for a solution to something. And so that's really the place that we're trying to get to with all of the different skills that we teach our patients in DBT. Mindfulness is one of the skills that we really try to use to cultivate this wise sense of mind. And that gives us that observer stance of being able to sort of both allow the emotions I have in the moment and still think reasonably and rationally about how I might want to problem solve something.
So somebody finds themselves stuck in what you're calling emotion mind. They're clearly having some type of major reactive experience to whatever's going on. What would be your suggestion for how they could deal with that on the spot to move towards wise mind?
Well, the very first thing that I think anyone who recognizes that they're in emotion mind needs to do is to calm their body down. Because really, emotions are fundamentally a physiological response. And we all know that sensation that we can get when we're in emotion mind, right? That our heart starts to pound, we start to feel hot, maybe we feel shaky, maybe we feel a little nauseous, maybe we feel energized and tense and ready to jump, right? But there's something going on in our body. And so our brains don't actually work very well in taking perspective and thinking rationally and reasonably when we're in that kind of a state of mind. So we first need to calm down our body so our brain can work more clearly. And so I ask all of my patients to do knee relaxation exercises, breathing exercises, little visualization exercises to actually calm down their sort of hot physical state first. And then from there, we start to use some of the other skills of challenging the way we're thinking, looking for the facts in a situation rather than just using our opinion and our what I would call hot thoughts that support my emotional feeling. And then there's a whole other range of skills that we use. But it almost always starts with figuring out how to get your body calmer.
Okay. So I think I understand the basic idea of calming the body. I am interested in learning more about how to find the facts in a situation, especially one where I'm determined to flush myself down the toilet as a terrible person. How do I move into a more factual viewpoint of what might be happening?
Well, I think we do it by asking questions, right? And really challenging the thoughts we have by asking for evidence. So if I decide that I took a test and I don't have my score yet, but I've decided that I've done horribly, and I've decided that I've now must be stupid, and that I am going to fail out of school, and there's just no hope for me, and I'm a complete idiot, and see, I do this all the time. I never am successful with anything. This is going to be yet another example. And then I'm off to the races and feeling horrible. And I might then engage in some also destructive behavior in addition to this destructive self-talk that I'm engaged in. So I would stop and ask a patient to please write down all those thoughts, the thoughts that I just mentioned. We'll call those the hot thoughts, right? The negative thinking. And then I ask them to go through sort of one statement at a time and give me some evidence for that. So let's start with the first statement of, I know I failed. Well, how do you know you failed? You don't have the score yet. So that's actually, I mean, do you have a crystal ball? Like, where's the evidence for that? And I only allow people to sort of stick with the facts because we're not going to condemn ourselves over, the possibility that something's going to go wrong. So, but then they'll argue with me and they'll have all these reasons why, well, I know I got this one wrong and that one wrong and that one wrong. And so, okay, but the reality is that you actually don't know. And you're telling yourself that you're certain. So, yeah, okay, that helps with the emotion, maybe like the tiniest little bit. And I feel a little bit better. And I'll wait, but don't just wait. I'll get the score back and I'll be able to feel bad again. So then we move on to the other statements of, I'm stupid. And I always do this. And then I ask the evidence for that. And sometimes people have evidence of, well, I failed the last test. Okay, that's a bit of evidence. How is that evidence that you're stupid? And then we start to challenge bit by bit this idea that, well, even if someone got a poor grade on one test, that doesn't actually make them stupid. Why does that make you stupid? Does it naturally follow that you have to be considered stupid just because you didn't do well on this test? And, usually, and I'm actually, as I'm giving this example, I'm thinking of a patient of mine who we just went through this exact thing. And guess what? It turned out she got an A on the test. And in fact, when we were going through this cognitive process, she realized that these are the thoughts I have every single time. And well, no, actually, I haven't ever failed a test in this semester or in the last couple semesters. And even when I've done a little less well than I hoped I'd do, in the end, I've always been able to do in a little extra work and do fine. But that this was just this place she goes. And the more we do these exercises, the more people start to recognize the patterns of the ways that they beat up on themselves. And it becomes more automatic where you actually have the thought and you don't necessarily even have to go through the whole process anymore because you, like I said before, you sort of recognize, oh, this is my racket. This is the thing I tell myself when I'm really, really afraid or when I'm really, really worried.
Okay, but Aaron, I mean, I have to offer some examples like this. Somebody who says, I've never really made much of my career. And in fact, they haven't made much of their career. They've been in the same dead-end job that they started and are being, seriously not paid very much money. Or, I think I'm quite fat. And in fact, that person is quite fat, obese by, any scale. So, what about in those situations?
In those situations, I think, it's interesting that you mention this because one of the things that I ask people to do a lot when they come in with this idea that like everything, I suck and everything in my life sucks and everything has to change. And I ask people to really make a list for me of, what is it that you really think is so horrible about yourself? And really, we're going to divide that list into things that are true and I can't do anything about it. So I'm going to have to figure out how to like myself, even though this is the case. That things that are true, but I can do something about it, in which case we're going to set course on how do I start to remove obstacles to actually starting to change those things. And then which things actually aren't true at all. And that's from my previous example of, yeah, this is just the shtick I use. And I tell myself all these things about myself that aren't true, but I do that because I'm in emotion mind, right? And so if we can divide the list into these three things, we're going to do different things with those three lists. But for things like I am overweight and I am in self-hatred about it, well, your self-hatred is making it harder to lose weight. So, what can we do about forgiving yourself for the fact that you're here? And then set a course for how we're actually going to help you lose weight because hey, you are going to be healthier and you are going to feel better if you could lose some weight. So we're not going to, you know, let's not be Pollyanna positive about this and say, yeah, no, it's okay, you should stay fat. No, we're going to actually work on that. But beating yourself up about it is not the way to actually lose weight, right? It's the thing that makes me go grab the food when I'm feeling so disgusting about myself, right? And so how am I going to sit still, allow myself to feel that, and then forgive myself and have some compassion for myself for the fact that this is really hard and I'm emotionally triggered? And then what else am I going to use besides the food to go help myself feel better in that moment?
Okay, so I want to circle back and just dig a little bit deeper on this question of forgiveness, because I'm imagining someone who's listening and they say, you know, I hear the word, but I just don't know quite how to do that when I'm feeling really judgmental of myself about something.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know that I have the best answer for it, because I think that it's about trying to accept, maybe in the beginning, just that I am having a hard time forgiving myself, right? Like that we got to almost start where you are. And then if you're feeling so angry with yourself or so sort of critical of yourself that you don't even, you can't even imagine how to forgive, you know, from the perspective of starting with, okay, so can you forgive the child that this all started with? Can you forgive the circumstances? Can you accept the circumstances that got you here? Well, if you can't, then maybe I just have to actually sit still and feel how hard it is for me to even forgive myself in this moment. And can I have compassion for how hard it is to forgive things that we wish we would have done differently? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that that is about sitting still and tolerating the feelings, because, you know, I think a lot of my patients come and think that I'm going to have all the answers for how they're going to feel okay. And pain is a part of life, right? And we aren't going to feel good about everything, and we aren't perfect. And there are things that we can't change and do have to live with that are not good, right? And that's something that I can't do anything about, right? I can't help them with that in any way other than helping them not add on to the pain by creating more suffering in the non-acceptance, in the it shouldn't be this way and therefore I deserve to not be here anymore kind of way. So I think that, you know, to hope for no pain in it is not realistic in some cases. If there's truly some real authentic sort of negative stuff there.
Erin, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to share with us personally for a moment. You used this term, the racket that we run inside, that many of us have some kind of racket about ourselves, some kind of patterned sort of self-talk that we're used to as a way to not be kind to ourselves. And I'm curious to know if you've identified a quote-unquote racket that you've had historically in your life and how potentially you've dealt with that.
Yeah, I would say that my racket is less of the I'm not good enough racket that I see happens so often for people, but it's more the I hold myself to a really high standard and like, wait, why can't I do more? Why didn't I do more? So I can start from a basic level of, oh, I can accept that I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, I can do this, I can succeed and have and will, but like, wait a second, why can't I do more? And what if I worked harder? And so my racket is to push myself too much to a place of not being in balance, actually. And that's when I can beat up on myself a little bit. And the thing that I do is try to sort of step back and say, hold on, you, what are the facts here? Can you do that all? What would happen? What will actually slide? What won't you do well if you try to do X and Y and Z and all these things that you're telling yourself you should be able to do? So, you know, and maybe I need to ask for help instead of deciding that I have to do things all by myself. And that doesn't come so easily to me. And so that's what I have to catch myself in every once in a while.
Thank you. That's helpful. One final question. With Sounds True, you've created an audio program that specifically works on freeing oneself from anxiety. And I'm curious to know how anxiety plays in here when we're in emotion mind, and what your thoughts are about that, specifically related to this question of liberating ourselves from emotion mind and moving towards self-acceptance.
Well, I think that anxiety and fear can sometimes be the primary emotion that we're experiencing in the world. And then that directly leads us to the secondary emotion of shame and of feeling, sort of beating ourselves up for, why am I not better able to face this fear and anxiety? And so I think that that's how I see it often very related, that I see a lot of my patients who suffer biologically from a real predisposition to feeling quite anxious, and that they are just absolutely their worst critics about their expectations of how they should be able to handle it better. And that adds this extra layer of emotion mind, of emotionality, that makes it that much harder to get out of a state of real anxiety, right? So I often try to help people see that I have the pain of an anxiety attack. Why in the world do I want to add on the suffering of hating myself for the fact that I'm having this panic attack, right? So why don't we just stick with the primary emotion? Hold on for a second. Let me see if, when I actually try to address the primary emotion, if maybe I can be a little bit prouder of myself by actually allowing myself to do it. Sort of, you know, I think a lot of my patients suffer from this nasty coach syndrome, right? Where we have these models, like in our sports world, of you know, different kinds of coaches, right? Where there's the one that like breaks you down and tells you that you're nothing and you have to try harder, and right? And I think that we have this idea that somehow that's how we actually get better at things. But that's the research actually suggests, and I think my own experience and probably most people's experience shows, that it's much nicer when someone's actually supporting you and saying, like, come on, you can do it, and come on, do better, but I know you can do it. I'm here to help you with this. Let's attack this problem, right? And does it from a place of compassion and kindness and toughness, but kindness. And so that's what I often try to get my patients to understand, especially when they're dealing with lots of anxiety and maybe even depression, that beating up on yourself is not going to get you out of the hole faster. Offering yourself a hand and saying, it's okay, you're starting where you're starting, let's do this together, I can do this with you, let's take it one step at a time, that's the way out of the hole of anxiety or depression, right? And not to sort of add on in that way.
Really, you're describing developing an inner compassion coach, if you will.
Exactly. Absolutely. And, you know, I have a teenage patient that we call her inner critic, the mean girl. And she, you know, we say, oh my gosh, the mean girl is here. And she's just like running the show right now. And where is the sweet, nice friend, right? You need your friend to come, your nice girlfriend to come and help you out of this place that you're in right now. Let's not send in the mean girl, because she's not going to help you deal with this. And so I think that we all sort of have that, those sort of two voices on a regular basis. And I think that we have to try to go for the wise mind voice that is compassionate and loving and kind and can be tough at times and really help us change things, rather than going for that mean critic that sort of lurks there in emotion mind.
I've been speaking with Dr. Erin Olivo as part of the Self-Acceptance Project. Thank you so much for bringing your voice to the conversation, a wise and helpful voice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Erin Olivo has created with Sounds True a program called Free Yourself from Anxiety, a Mind-Body Prescription. SoundsTrue.com. Many voices, one journey. Thanks for listening.